Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is the takeaway for Monday, March 12th, 2018. Thanks for downloading the podcast. We're here every day for you. And if you don't subscribe already, please do. And give us a rating. It really helps us out. Thanks.
Save Ghouta. That was the plea of a child whose home was destroyed in an airstrike late last month in eastern Ghouta. It's an enclave of almost 400,000 people east of Damascus in Syria. I'm Todd Zwillick, and this is The Takeaway. That child's cry for help comes from a city under siege, recorded by the BBC. Mortars and airstrikes from Syrian government forces rain down on civilians in eastern Ghouta. The government says they're trying to oust opposition fighters who've controlled the region since 2013. Since the most recent campaign began last month, hundreds have been killed in the fighting. But violence is nothing new. Residents have been hostages in their own city for 5 years. Dr. Mohamed Katoub has lived that experience. He's a dentist, born in eastern Ghouta. He raised his family there, but everything changed after the uprising. Dr. Katoub recently published a report on the plight of eastern Ghouta for the Syrian American Medical Society. And he spoke with me at the end of last week from the border town of Gaziantep in Turkey.
Eastern Ghouta is just 10 kilometers away from the capital. It's the food basket where there are a lot of agriculture and the highway taking to the north. Also, Eastern Ghouta is a wealthy area where there are many factories, many industries inside this area with big population. Now it's 400,000 people, but in 2010 it was over 1 million. This area became in 2013 completely under siege and had been suffering from the siege and its consequences since that time.
Now, you left in 2014 for Turkey, where you are now. What were conditions like when you left?
Ghouta that time was under siege since 7 or 8 months, where there is no food, there is no medicines. This area had the highest rate of malnutrition since the beginning of the crisis in Syria. The issue is winter because heating is very difficult, especially there is no fuel. And when it's found that it's not affordable, like 1 liter of diesel is about $10 to $12 that time. And people started to use alternatives like the wood for heating and for cooking. But at the end, you need the fuel to run the electric generators, at least for the hospitals, at least to run the incubators, at least for the intensive care unit, for the ventilators for the patients to keep alive. And for also transportation and just to deliver food from one place to another, just for the bakeries, just for ambulances to work. It was too hard to get fuel that time, and we lost many lives because of shortage of medicines or basic needs. Day after day, the people started to find alternatives from the local resources or smuggling. People started to dig tunnels. The tunnels were connecting Ghouta with other non-government areas, which is not under siege. It was not easy. It was under high taxes, and people had to pay much more than the prices of the same items in Damascus, just 10 kilometers away. But in a way or another, people could find resources to survive. In 2017, all of this was blocked. The government seized those areas, which was the resources of those items, and then the whole area became under complete siege. No one could get in and out. We started to lose our capacity as medical staff working there. My colleagues who work there started to block some services because they don't have the supplies. We started to have a bigger number of people who need to be treated outside even many of them can be treated inside Ghouta if we have the access. And we started to seek for medical evacuation for those people, which is not ideal because medical evacuation for 100, 200, 300, and then what? And even those hundreds of people who need the evacuation couldn't find a way to be treated outside of Ghouta. The list now is over 1,000 patients who need to be evacuated. This morning, I received news about patients number 27 who die from this list, but this is not the whole suffering.
Well, how many doctors are left to treat the people of Eastern Ghouta?
There are only 107. It's one doctor for 3,600 people. When suddenly you receive 100 injuries because an airstrike targeted a market or a mosque or a school or even a hospital, you receive this big number of people in the emergency room, and then you have only one vascular surgeon in the whole area, only one cubby from this very important, very precious specialties in war zones. And then from those 100, you might have 7 or 8 or 9, I don't know, it depends on how the injuries looks like, people who need vascular surgeries. Of course, there are medical standards where the doctors will use to make the priorities for such situations. But when you have also shortage of medicines, then you have to choose who to live, to who to die. And basically, they choose the cases which have the high chances to survive. And it's not only about injuries. It's about many other diseases. I know a kid who is the same age of my child, Faris. They were born in the same month, and they grow up together. Those two kids were sharing toys. They were sharing even the limited food that we had that time. And me and his father are friends, so sometimes even when we were lucky to find one bag of diapers for the kids, we were sharing it for the two kids. And this boy, his name is Osama, needed antiviral, which is available in every pharmacy in Damascus, just 10 kilometers away. And we couldn't secure the antiviral for him. This happened last September, and I'm here in Turkey, helpless, can't help him. And the father, the friend, was calling me to tell me, please do anything to help. I was pushing the ICRC, please bring the medicine to Osama. And the convoy of the UN entered the same month, and they were not allowed to bring specialized medicines, only things for primary health care. And Osama passed away after 9 days in the intensive care unit. The Syrian government is putting obstacles in front of those convoys to bring the needed items, especially those medical supplies. And the recent one, which entered just 2 days ago, the WHO announced that 70% of life-saving items were removed from the convoy before it entered Eastern Ghouta. Since the beginning of 2017, I'm talking about 15 months now, only 11 convoys entered Ghouta, bringing less than 10% of the needs.
Dr. Katoub, you also describe skyrocketing rates of infectious diseases like typhoid, and you mentioned chemical attack. There have been reports of chemical attack in Eastern Ghouta. Can you describe what types of symptoms doctors are seeing that can be attributed to chemical attack, what the evidence is that the government is attacking civilians in this way?
Chemical attacks is not something new in Syria, not something new in Ghouta. This is the area where the chemical massacre in August 21st, 2013 happened. Since the beginning of this year, we reported 9 chemical attacks in Syria. 6 of them were in Ghouta. The doctors depends on describing the symptoms. And after this long experience with 198 attacks in Syria, doctors developed their capacity, and they received many trainings on this. In this area, they were receiving trainings online from experts outside to just verify and identify the symptoms. But in the same time, they don't have the lab tests to identify the chemical agent, like it's sarin or it's mustard gas or it's any other type of phosphorus compounds. But it's very clear when it comes to even if it's chlorine or it's phosphorus compounds, because the nerval symptoms will not appear in the people who are exposed to chlorine. How we know that this is the Syrian government? It's not us who is saying the Syrian government is doing this. It's the joint investigation mechanism of the UN Security Council. 7 reports came from this joint investigation mechanism, which is combined between UN experts and experts from the Organization of Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. And they investigated those attacks. And in 7 reports, they talked about the usage of chemical weapons by the Syrian government. And they proved it. And when it comes to us, we know because mostly it's aerial bombardment. And the opposition don't have any air forces.
Dr. Khatoub, I'd like to end with a little bit of your own story. You mentioned your own escape in 2014 with your family in the dead of night. Can you talk a little bit more about that night and how you and your family got to safety?
Well, in 2014, after about 7 or 8 months of the siege, we couldn't be anymore. It's because of the little child, Faris, who was less than 1 year that time. When we left, he was almost 1 year old. We couldn't find medicines for him. If I'm the doctor who work in logistics for hospitals, can't find medicines for my children, can't find diapers for my child. So how about other people? So we decided at that time to leave just for the future of the children. My wife could go through the checkpoints. We could pay some money for the checkpoints to allow her out of Ghouta. But for me, they told me that it's too risky. And I know that many of my colleagues who work in humanitarian aid were tortured to death in the Syrian government prisons just because they work as humanitarian workers in the opposition areas. So it was too dangerous to go through the government areas to flee out of the country. So I fled May the 6th in 2014. I worked for 2 nights. It was too dangerous to work during the day. So during the day, we were hiding in some place. We were avoiding to go through mines. There were snipers along the way. Even in some places, there were cameras. The guide who readed this, only 5 people who escaped, was an expert on the road, so he could avoid all of this. But 2 days before I left, 3 people died in the same way because of the mines. So it took almost about 20 days to Turkey to meet my wife and child here in Istanbul.
Before I let you go, Dr. Khatoub, in a sentence or two, what is your message for the world, for listeners who are hearing your description of what's going on in Eastern Ghouta and what's going on in Syria right now?
Unfortunately, it's the governments who are failing us, who are watching war crimes day after day in Ghouta. And as you started, it's even much worse than Aleppo because there were hundreds of reports and hundreds of statements from UN officials and governments talking about Aleppo and that this will not happen again. This is the area in Ghouta, this is the area of the red lines of Obama in 2013. And it's the red lines of Macron again now. It's the same area where chemical weapons are used again and again. So there is no red lines in this world. People around the world will definitely defend humanity in any place, but it's all about governments who are failing us.
Dr. Mohammed Khatoub, Advocacy Manager for Turkey for the Syrian American Medical Society. Dr. Khatoub, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
We go to the UK now, in southern England, where a little more than a week ago, a former Russian spy named Sergei Skripal was found unconscious on a park bench along with his daughter, both poisoned, apparently, by a rare and deadly nerve agent. And the prime suspects? Agents working for Moscow. And while there's no hard proof here, Russia does have a history of poisonings and murders of people it considers traitors and dissidents. You might remember the case of Russian organized crime investigator and dissident Alexander Litvinenko, who was poisoned with polonium and died in the UK in 2006. Emily Tamkin is a staff writer for Foreign Policy magazine.
Skripal, as you know, was a spy in Russia, sort of switched to work for the British government, was in prison for this from 2006 to 2010, and then made his way to Britain as part of a spy swap. He did not stop being helpful to quote-unquote friendly spying agencies after that. So while he probably wasn't quite in the middle of things in the same way that he was when he was spying in Moscow or immediately thereafter, he is someone who is seen as a traitor to the Russian government.
Well, I guess the second part of the question then is, why now?
That's a very good question and something that we don't quite know at this moment. It's 8 years after the fact. And the fact that it is so much later calls into question the utility of spy swaps in the first place, right? The whole premise is that they're safe once they're returned or out of the government. So to do this 8 years later, to do it in such a spectacular way where so many innocent people were, not that Skripal was not innocent, but so many other innocent people were also impacted, and to do it in a way that jeopardizes the sort of trope of espionage, right, is that these are all questions that we still do not have answers to.
What message is Russia sending around the world? Russian state media has been taunting Russian nationals who live in the UK. So they are trying to send a pretty loud message here.
Yes. So regardless of the message that was supposed to be sent with the attack, if it was indeed Russia, as it by all accounts appears to be, the tone they've taken since, and you can see this on the Russian embassy in the UK Twitter account, you can see this on Russian state media. This media host said, this TV host rather, said, "Russians, I beg of you, just don't go live in Britain. Like, don't go live in the traitorous land of Britain." There was some British newspaper article that referred to Skripal as a Russian spy, and the Russian embassy in the UK Twitter account retorted, "Actually, he was a spy in Britain," and sort of has said similar things about, you know, what he and I believe it was Berezovsky who was sort of the man who made Putin before he came to the UK and became a very public critic of the regime, and he was found dead in his home a few years ago, sort of that, you know, these are traitors and that's what they have in common. It's interesting that they would seemingly sort of winkingly take the blame for an attempted murder, unless you look at it in the context of their diplomatic rhetoric today more broadly, which has been quite trolling, as they say, you know, kind of half winking, half smirking, half, yeah, we know. It's much more similar to the way that they speak of the alleged election interference, right? The sort of, yeah, we know what you did and you know what we did, but we're going to sort of like wink at you and smirk rather than come forward and take accountability.
Well, so many taunts from Russian diplomats, at least their social media, and from Russian TV hosts aimed at Russian nationals in the UK. Emily, why are there so many Russians in the UK now? Seems like there are a lot.
Not just Russian nationals. There's so much Russian money in London, right? It is accepted that if you are a member of the Russian elite, if you are part of Russia's sort of inner circle, you have property, you have money in London. So one idea that Marina Litvinenko, the widow of Alexander Litvinenko, who was prior to this the most high profile case involving poison and a former Russian spy, has floated, as has Bill Browder, who's this very, very public critic of the Putin regime, has been to go after the Russian money that's in London, right? Like, why should you be able to allegedly attempt to murder a British spy, right? Somebody who's supposed to be safe on British soil. Why should you be allowed to do that and still keep your money in, you know, in Chelsea? And indeed, over this past weekend, news came out that the British government is preparing a UK version of what we in the US have known as the Magnitsky Act, named for Bill Browder's late accountant and lawyer, who Browder believes was killed in prison and certainly died in prison after reporting state theft of $230 million.
Well, let's talk about the Magnitsky Act. It's been on the books here since 2012. What does it do?
Basically, it goes after high-profile Russians who are seen as being involved in the crime against Magnitsky. But basically, it goes after their money and their travel power, right? So it says you cannot come to the United States and you cannot use the U.S. banking system. It's very different from other sanctions, at least in the U.S., in that typically sanctions are not meant to – they're not meant as punitive. They're not meant to send a message. So, and there is some debate in the U.S. as to whether or not these sanctions actually do change Russian behavior. The counterargument to that is it's a symbol that we stand with whistleblowers and human rights activists and dissidents. And further, why should you be able to steal and to kill and still use our banking system? And that is certainly the argument that I think we're going to hear a lot of in the UK in the coming days.
So, Emily, there's a Magnitsky Act under debate in the UK, but a lot of debate in the UK about how to respond to this latest attack. And a lot of it centers around Theresa May, the Prime Minister, because Theresa May was on the scene back in 2014 when the UK was trying to figure out how to react to the last high-profile attack that you already mentioned, Alexander Litvinenko, who was poisoned with polonium on British soil.
Exactly. So what happened in the Litvinenko case was that they were not able to extradite the two people that they wanted to from Russia. Judge Robert Owens then asked for a public inquiry, and originally then Home Secretary Theresa May denied that. It's widely believed that this was so as not to damage British-Russian relations. Later, a public inquiry was allowed. But she is seen as somebody who sort of dragged out the very long process that was the Litvinenko case and helped to sort of make that a more difficult process. So there is some pressure on her, particularly because there's so much Russian money. There have been reports on how much Russian money or money from Russian nationals goes to the Tory party. So there's going to be pressure on her and on her conservative government to respond to this in a way that's seen as not sort of placating Russia or being in Russian pockets. In some ways, this is easier now than it was in 2013, right? The change in the Litvinenko case came after Crimea and after the war in eastern Ukraine broke out and after the downing of MH17. And I would argue that British-Russian relations, like Western-Russian relations in general, are quite bad. And there's not much that you could salvage by not responding to this in a very public, forceful way.
Emily Tamkin, staff writer at Foreign Policy Magazine. Thank you so much, Emily.
Thank you.
During the Cold War, the American military went to great lengths to gain an edge over the Soviet Union. An estimated 7,000 U.S. soldiers were exposed to dangerous chemicals, essentially guinea pigs, in top-secret experiments at the Edgewood Arsenal in Maryland. Well, decades later, many of those soldiers haven't even been notified of the potential health consequences of those experiments, and they haven't been able to get medical treatment from the government. Carson Frame has the story of one veteran's struggle to get care.
The Army's Medical Research Volunteer Program at Edgewood Arsenal skirted the boundaries of medical ethics to prepare America for chemical warfare. Some soldiers tested protective clothing, while others were exposed to nerve agents, mustard gas, and psychoactive drugs. Most didn't realize what they'd signed up for.
I was naive. I was patriotic. My government would never hurt me. And, you know, at first it's embarrassing to know you were sucked in.
Bob Crafty was just out of his teens when, in 1965, he was offered temporary duty at Edgewood. The Army told him he'd be helping end the war in Vietnam. Crafty remembers the experiments vividly. The Army put him in a padded room for 3 days and made him breathe an aerosol pesticide used by the military as a nerve agent.
They put it over my nose and mouth. Yeah, I felt weak, dizzy.
Since then, Crafty has developed health problems, hand tremors, symptoms of post-traumatic stress, and eventually cancer. Decades after leaving the service, he found out through his own research that he had been exposed to the dangerous chemicals. But when Crafty obtained his Army health records and applied for VA disability benefits, he was rejected. In 2013, a federal court ordered the Army to notify Edgewood veterans of possible long-term health effects. It later required the Army to provide them with medical care, too. Ben Patterson is a lawyer representing the veterans.
That notice is important, one, so vets can get, you know, proper medical treatment and understand the diagnosis for their particular health problems, but also because benefits claims processes. For example, with the VA, they need that additional support in order to get their claims granted.
Starting in November, the Army mailed about 4,000 letters to test vets around the country. They included applications for medical care, but made no direct mention of Edgewood or the specific chemicals vets were exposed to. Some veterans, like Bob Crafty, never even received a letter. Others that did face an uphill battle to qualify for care and get their health information.
I don't think these guys are acting in good faith. I didn't receive any notification or application from them, and I know they have my files. They sent them to me 3 times.
But the Army says notifying vets isn't as easy as it sounds. Bill Fitzhugh is with the Army Public Health Center. He says some of the records from Edgewood have been destroyed or are difficult to make sense of.
The major issues that we're talking about is our data is incomplete. The data that we're dealing with sometimes is handwritten notes, notebooks. It's definitely not automated.
Even veterans who receive letters don't have an easy time responding. They have to gather decades-old service documents and return them to the government. As of February 1st, the Army had only received 64 medical care applications out of an estimated 1,000 living Edgewood veterans. Fitzhugh says it will be a while before the Army's outreach gains traction.
I was kind of surprised to see how many we got as quickly as we did, but we're expecting to see the number increase over time. And that's just for the known veterans, so the ones that we send out notification letters to. So that's one of the big things we're working on right now is how do we reach out to all of these veterans?
That's a question Bob Crafty spends a lot of time thinking about. He managed to get a copy of the Army's medical care application on his own, but he says his fellow aging veterans can't wait any longer. This is Carson Frame reporting.
putting lawmakers on notice. They must work swiftly to follow the law and pass an education budget by April 1st. If that budget doesn't include a meaningful pay raise for teachers and support professionals and additional funding to restore cuts to Oklahoma classrooms, OEA calls for statewide school closures beginning April 2nd.
You're listening there to Alicia Priest, the president of the Oklahoma Education Association, that's the teachers union, in a Facebook message last week. The state has the lowest paid educators in the country, and teachers say they're sick and tired of getting shortchanged. Is a teacher strike in the offing in Oklahoma? Emily Wendler covers education for State Impact Oklahoma. Hi, Emily.
Hi, Todd.
Well, we heard the head of Oklahoma's teachers union right there, a strike beginning April 2nd if teachers and school support workers don't get a pay increase. What are their demands?
They want $10,000 teacher pay raise over 3 years, $5,000 pay increase for support professionals like secretaries, custodians, $200 million in restored funding for public education in general over 3 years. And even state employees are joining this. They want raises, too, because they haven't had raises in 12 years. So it's quite a big ask at this point.
So Oklahoma, though, is number 50 on that list of teacher pay in the country. That stands out. Are lawmakers responding, trying to fix that number 50 ranking?
Yeah, it's not like lawmakers have been, you know, sitting around twiddling their thumbs. There's definitely been an effort to raise teacher pay. None of these efforts have been successful so far.
Where might the money come from to boost salaries here?
Democrats really want oil and gas companies to pay more. Oklahoma is rich in oil and gas, and oil and gas companies here have some of the lowest gross production tax rates in the nation. And so Democrats are really focused on making those companies pay more. Republicans are having a hard time asking, you know, kind of the lifeblood of the state to pay more. They worry if they raise the taxes too much on these companies that they'll go elsewhere.
So, Emily, a lot of this sounds familiar, though. Teachers in West Virginia just went back to classes last week after a strike that spanned 3 school weeks. I would guess that teachers in Oklahoma have been watching that effort and maybe lawmakers, too.
A lot of people have asked me, like, do you think that the teachers in Oklahoma are doing this because of the teachers in West Virginia? And I say yes and no. I mean, there has been a lot of rumbling, a lot of anger in this state for years. Starting a couple months ago, I think the conversation started about a teacher walkout. But it really became unified when one teacher from Stillwater, Oklahoma, was watching the news about West Virginia teachers, and he thought to himself, you know, I'm going to make a Facebook page. So in that instance, yes, he watched the West Virginia teachers striking on TV, got on his computer, made a Facebook page called Oklahoma Teacher Walkout, The Time Is Now, and it quickly blew up. You know, it's been like 10 days and it has 60,000 members and the teachers are pretty ready to go.
What are parents and students saying about the prospect of teachers going to the mat here with the state?
No, obviously, I have not spoken to all parents, but, you know, on this Facebook page, there's a lot of people on it. It's not just teachers. There's a lot of parents on there. And repeatedly, I've seen parents say, I support you. We will find a way to take care of our kids. We will figure it out. Now, obviously, there's a lot of parents who aren't so fortunate, who are going to have to take off of work or are going to have to find childcare. There's a lot of kids who get fed at school. So that's a worry for people as well. But I have seen a lot of support from the community in general for these teachers.
What's your sense about the likelihood of this being solved in the next couple of weeks, but before the 2nd of April?
Lawmakers have been butting heads for years about how to get this done. They really need to just come together. They need to set everything aside and they need to come to an agreement. They're going to have to set their egos aside, a lot of things aside to get this done. And that's the only way it's going to get done. I think there's an uphill battle. I think it can be done. I think there's definitely a will. They just need to do it.
West Virginia echoing in Oklahoma as teachers threaten a strike at the beginning of April if their pay isn't increased. Emily Wendler covering education for State Impact Oklahoma. Thanks, Emily.
Thank you.
Well, Let's go to Pennsylvania now, just outside of Pittsburgh, in fact. This area was once home to America's steel industry, and it's lost a lot of jobs over the last generation. The 18th Congressional District is ground zero for the Donald Trump phenomenon. Unions are still strong, Democrats outnumber Republicans, but President Trump crushed Hillary Clinton here in 2016, and it helped Donald Trump become the first Republican to win Pennsylvania since 1988. Well, now that phenomenon is being put to the test. There's a special election tomorrow in the Pennsylvania 18th, and even though President Trump won the district by 20 points, the race between Republican Rick Saccone and Democrat Connor Lamb is a dead heat.
I love this place. Hello, Pittsburgh. Hello, Pittsburgh. You know what? Do me a favor. Get out on Tuesday. Vote for Rick Saccone, and we can leave right now. Come on.
President Trump landed and spoke for about an hour in Moon Township, Pennsylvania, on Saturday. Just about 10 minutes of that speech was about the Republican candidate, Rick Saccone. The rest veered from journalist Chuck Todd to Oprah Winfrey and from Martha Stewart to CNN. Well, Connor Lamb has gotten help from the likes of Joe Biden and other Democrats. Over the weekend, he talked about Medicare and Social Security.
People have paid into these programs over the course of a lifetime. I do not believe, as Paul Ryan does, that these are entitlements or another form of welfare.
This race in Pennsylvania, how did a 20-point win in 2016 become a toss-up in 2018? And what do President Trump and Republicans have at stake in the Pittsburgh suburbs? Bridget Bowman covers politics for Roll Call.
At this point, we don't know who's going to win on Tuesday. And it looks like Connor Lamb, the Democrat in the race, has really been able to appeal to Republican voters, more socially conservative voters in the district to really make this close.
So why would this race be so close right now? What does this tell us about the state of politics just a few months before 2018 really ramps up?
Sure. So this district is kind of interesting politically. Just to give you some background, so this is in southwestern Pennsylvania, includes the Pittsburgh suburbs, some old coal towns, steel mining towns, a lot of working class voters, a lot of union members in the district. So this is a key part of President Trump's coalition in 2016. So Democrats have been trying to figure out how to win back some of these voters who used to be solidly Democrat. And it seems like Connor Lamb is trying to show people how it's done, essentially, appealing to some of these blue-collar workers who may be more conservative on social issues like gun control, abortion even, but talking a lot about economic issues, protecting Social Security and Medicare is a big part of his message, and also really energizing union members in the district. A number of the unions are backing Connor Lamb as well. In terms of what it tells us for 2018 moving forward, it'll be interesting to see what kind of message Democrats take, either if Lamb wins or if he gets close, in terms of what kind of candidate they should run in these districts. Should they be more kind of conservative centrist like Lamb is doing? Or, you know, there's this fight in the party right now over whether people who are more stridently progressive should be the ones to get through and to try and win in some of these places. On the Republican side, national Republicans are certainly watching this to see if, you know, messages like tying Lamb to House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi or touting their tax overhaul, if that's going to resonate in places like this. And so far, it's close, despite the millions and millions of dollars that Republicans have spent on this race as well. And they're already starting to blame Rick Saccone, saying that he was, not a good candidate for them and couldn't raise the money necessary to compete.
Well, let's talk about Rick Saccone just for a second and Connor Lamb, too. Who are these guys?
Right. So they're both veterans. They have different backgrounds, though. So Connor Lamb, this is his first run for political office, even though his family is active politically in the area. He's 33 years old, a Marine veteran. He's a former federal prosecutor, something he talks a lot about on the campaign trail. And Rick Saccone is a state representative. He was first elected to the state house in 2010. He's also a veteran of the Air Force. He's an Air Force intelligence officer. And so he's been really touting his experience. He argues that Connor Lamb doesn't have enough experience to really jump into Congress and, you know, make a mark, and that he does. He often says, I have a record and you need to take a look at it. But what I've heard from some people about Connor Lamb when I was up there last week was that he's a fresh face. He's someone that is new and is open to working with both sides.
So, Bridget, you mentioned that this corner of southwest Pennsylvania has a lot of old coal towns, a lot of old steel towns. President Trump was just there over the weekend. We just heard from him. How is the president's announcement on steel and aluminum tariffs playing in this part of the world? And what role are unions playing in this race?
Right. So it's not totally clear yet if his announcement on tariffs will have any impact. I was talking to a local county Republican Party chairman late last week, and he said he didn't know if it would move the needle in this election. He thought maybe if the announcement had come a couple weeks earlier and people could start to hear some of, you know, factories hiring more jobs and some of the effects of it, that maybe it would have more of an impact. But unions have been really active in this race. So it is worth noting that the former congressman who held this district, who resigned, Tim Murphy, he was able to create a coalition of some Democrats and especially organized labor. He had the support of unions in this district. But now unions are backing the Democrat, Connor Lamb. They really see Rick Saccone as someone who would not support their interests based on some votes that he's taken in the state house.
So, Bridget, this 18th district, though, Pennsylvania has just redrawn its electoral map under a court order. It was a big fight. We've covered it. Mm-hmm. This 18th district, as it looks now, isn't even going to be around in a couple of more months. So what does that mean? Does that mean that this race that everyone is paying attention to is just purely a political test right now, a measure of President Trump's appeal heading into 2018?
Right. That's been one of the kind of fascinating things about this race is that it's a huge fight over a district that is essentially disappearing. And part of that is, like you said, it's a bigger political message. I talked to one Republican strategist in the race and I asked that strategist, when the redistricting happened, did you change your thinking about how much you wanted to get involved? And they said no, because for them, this is an important test to show going into the midterms that they can withstand some sort of wave. And Democrats, too, are focused on this race and sending a message going into 2018 that they're really energized and that they can even win in a solidly Republican district like this one.
Bridget Bowman covering politics for Roll Call, covering the race in the 18th District of Pennsylvania ahead of the 2018 elections. Bridget, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's The Takeaway. Welcome back. I'm Todd Zwillick. For the last several weeks, WNYC's Rebecca Carroll has been leading us through a book club series we're calling Reading the Reckoning. Well, this week, Rebecca sat down with three of you, our listeners, to discuss An American Marriage by Tayari Jones.
My takeaway was that the book was really sort of a microcosm of a much bigger issue. My name is Bennett Windheim. I'm from Washington Heights, New York.
The writer didn't make too many judgments about each voice. My name is Carol Severson, and I'm living in Prineville, Oregon.
What I appreciated about the book is the authenticity of the voices. Hi, my name is Michelle Watts, and I live in Cincinnati, Ohio. And thinking about this book from a Black feminist perspective, I think Black feminist frameworks really prioritize the lived experience and interiority and the idea that race and gender and choice and class all intersect in the lives of women and people in general, but women specifically. And this is something they have to grapple with on a daily basis. And, you know, that's what really made my heart go out to Celestial. At times she seems like she's really hard. Other times she seems she's vulnerable. And I think that's really important for a Black woman character to be allowed to be vulnerable, but you see that she is grappling with all of these choices on a very daily basis.
Bennett, I see you nodding your head to that.
I appreciate what Michelle had just said. You know, I think that class and some insecurities on his end, there were a lot of things. And somebody had mentioned, you know, that she's kind of cold or a little hard at times. And he's the more maternal figure.
Which is really, I mean, so interesting. And also, I think a little bit gendered, you know, that she is perceived as cold when in fact her language, her voice is so generous and gentle and giving and kind. But the fact that she was stating what she wanted is somehow synonymous with being cold.
And that's true regardless of race for women.
Yes.
And, you know, Bennett, you said something earlier about how quickly it fell apart. Early on in the novel, she references Roy's little flings.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like this was on really shaky grounds from the outset.
You're right. Roy was he does things that create a separation.
Right.
Phone numbers in the pocket, lying through omission. You know, when you're married to some, you're an open book. It was my perception that there was something, many things, little things that did not allow them to, you know, fully bond as a couple.
And you're speaking as a married person.
Yes,
who else is married here?
I'm married.
I have been married. I'm not married now.
Right. So I'm struck by this notion of when you're married, you do this. When you're married, it looks like this.
I agree. I recognized my own life in this book. I didn't get the sense that they had true comfort telling each other things.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that that was one of the seeds of discontent, that it wasn't comfortable for either of them to tell their most precious secrets.
I felt like they were deeply, deeply in love, and that it was a kind of, it was an agreement that they had negotiated without specific terms, and that
right.
that is what, that they both sort of agreed to the non-specificity of it is what drew them together.
And I think you're right about that, but then when this life-changing crisis came up, that's when I think it was important that they maybe should have had less of an open-ended arrangement.
For our listeners, spoiler alert, she did though, have room for Andre.
She did. She did.
Bennett, what were your thoughts about the Andre factor?
I didn't care about Andre. Andre was the third wheel. He was the problem beyond the
wow.
bigger problem. And I wondered what would have happened between Celestial and Roy were Andre not in the picture.
Oh.
But he was. And something that I'd like to add to that, because we're talking about the dynamics of a marriage and what is a marriage. And I'm looking at the title, and I think it's an American marriage. And I'm putting that in the context of today.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, there's no sacrifice in this marriage. Once he's incarcerated, he needs her to be his strength, to give him something to live for, to know that there's somebody out there, his spouse, who's supposed to be the closest person to you, to be there for him as he knows she's drifting away. She needs him to say, let me go. Understand that a marriage is only what two people do together and we're not together, and neither are willing to give the other what they need.
See, I think that what Celestial needs is for him to not be in prison. And he can't control
yes.
that.
That's right.
And
he
she can't
that.
Control that. But that is what she needs.
Okay, so what does she do to help him get out of that situation? Where is my advocate? Where is the outrage at this injustice? He says, I'm innocent. And she hears that, and her answer is, well, I'm innocent too.
Well, why it's is she not entitled to the same
she is.
Right of innocence and stating that?
She is, but you're looking at it from her point of view, and I'm trying to be empathetic from his point of view and say, I'm locked in this hell on earth.
So you're so
where it, where are you? What are you doing?
So your opinion or is objective, right? Because it's from the male perspective.
well, it's objective from the male perspective. I would.
Well, no,
yes,
that's what you're saying. Yes.
Yeah. I'm taking his side a little bit because I don't feel like anybody else is.
You are taking the side of how a marriage in America has been institutionalized and assigns roles to people. And you are suggesting that or stating that Celestial's role as his wife is to be his advocate and to sacrifice when so much of what black women have done and do, but historically we have been in advocacy roles for everyone, not just our spouses.
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, it resonated all that much more that she decided to choose what she needed for herself and be her own advocate.
And you know what's really interesting? I saw some web chatter that women in particular did not like Celestial's character. And I think it's precisely that we're so accustomed as black women to holding up our men. We go to marches when our men and boys get shot down. We support them to the ends of earth. And I think historically that's what we've done. But the fact that she chose herself is quite revolutionary if you look at it in that particular context. And I think,
and to be clear, she's not supporting
right,
him.
Right, absolutely.
Right.
She's just not supporting him as you know, as a wife. Right.
Okay, parting words, Bennett.
You know, for me as the father of a young black man and knowing the statistics, I worry. And so I project onto Roy certain things. And perhaps that's where my bias is coming from in this story too. But I think the whole situation is sad, and it's a bigger story than the marriage. It affects the individual, it affects the spouse, it affects the community. There's so much that it trickles down to so many other people.
Michelle?
This book, of course, talks about some of our most persistent problems, but what's so important is that it humanizes the people. It shows just how complicated it is. It shows what it does to families, but this book forces us to do so in a way that's beautiful and haunting, and in a way that will stay with the reader.
Carol?
It is beautiful. I have many people I want to give this book to now. I think about my own ill-fated marriage and how it is so important to maintain your individuality, regardless of the type of relationship you have.
Three very unique and thoughtful perspectives on this wide-ranging, intersectional, gorgeous novel, An American Marriage. Thank you all.
Thank you.
That's WNYC's Rebecca Carroll there in conversation with Carol Severson, Bennett Winheim, and Michelle Watts. Well, that's our show for today. If you missed any of the installments from our book club, including Rebecca Carroll's interview with Tiare Jones, you can find them all on the website at thetakeaway.org/series/readingthereckoning. Thanks so much for being with us and for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.